Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 20th, 2004. Today's session number is MOP 2004-02. Today's speaker is Philip Moat. The lesson for today is Global Environmental Challenges Solutions, Success Stories, Acid Rain, and Ozone Depletion. Let's listen in.
Once again, the monitor. Acknowledge my... Okay. Thank you. I want to acknowledge my projection staff up in the balcony there. Nat has brought his friend Abe along today. And I also want to encourage you, this is a little different format from yesterday. If you were here yesterday, there was no science yesterday, whereas today I'm going to go over a little more science and some policy and some history. And at every stage, you're very welcome to ask questions or to challenge something that I may have said that doesn't square with your recollection of news events and so on. So today, let's go to the next slide, which is the outline for the whole set of talks. Yesterday, we talked about biblical perspectives on global environmental issues. Today, it's a sort of rah-rah, yes, there is some good news, success stories, acid rain and ozone depletion. Tomorrow and Thursday, we talk about the current and future global environmental problems that are of great concern and are being wrestled with in somewhat incomplete fashion, global climate change, and species extinction. And then finally, we'll wrap up on Friday with solutions, particularly to the global climate change and species extinction problems. So, just a quick recap of yesterday, in case you weren't here. After looking at dozens of scriptures about the relationship between humans and the environment, I kind of identified four themes based on about 15 of the scriptures that we looked at. First, God created nature. It's very clear in the scriptures that God is the creator, and also that God gave nature purpose. Two purposes in particular, one to praise him, and the second to sustain human life. As part of that sustaining, God granted authority over creation to humans, but retains title to the created world. So it's not a license to despoil the world, but to treat it with some care. And then another theme that comes out of some of these passages is that the created world suffers because of our sin. And it's some of what we see happening in the pollution and things that we're dealing with in the environment today are also, in some ways, as we'll come to on Friday, related to human sin. So the conclusions that I drew last night, as these biblical themes relate to current issues, first of all, we the human race as a whole, have a responsibility to keep creation in good working order for our own sake, but also for the sake of the Creator who entrusted us with it. The second and third points here are that within that larger responsibility of the whole human race, there is also a responsibility, special responsibility for Christians who have this special perspective on environmental issues. Yes?
I'm going to ask a pretty ignorant question. When you say that humans have a responsibility to keep creation in good working order, does that imply that the rest of creation needs humans? Or can the rest of creation just exist without us?
That's an excellent question. And you know, there's certainly a stripe of thought within the environmental community that thinks that the world would be better off without humans. I've heard one colleague refer to us as a cancer on the face of the earth. I think that the biblical teaching on this is very clear that is not God's view of humans. That however much we may trammel his creation, that we are still very special to God. And that we are, in a sense, more important and more valuable than creation. However, in the creation story, we were sort of the last phase of creation, and so there was a period of time before humans, and that's the strict biblical sense. And of course, we know modern science says that Homo sapiens arose about 1 million years ago, and Earth had been inhabited by various species of organisms for about 2 billion years. So that's the sort of other timeline. And we also know that, from the biblical perspective, human sin in the garden corrupted an order that God created that had no killing in it. That, all of the animals were eating plants. And part of the corruption of the part of the curse as humans were expelled from the garden was also that there would be killing involved in sustaining life, that there would be predators and prey. Does that sort of answer your question? Okay. Let's go to the next. Okay, so in these two environmental challenges that I'll talk about today, acid rain and ozone depletion, there's a common pattern, and we'll also see this starting to play out tomorrow. The first is that scientists provided the first warning that something is amiss, that as we look around us, there are invisible changes that are only detectable with the instruments and the knowledge of science. And this is a fairly profound statement, that we're getting to the point where these kind of local environmental challenges that I mentioned yesterday, water pollution, air pollution, so on, that people see out their windows or they can smell the pollution or whatnot, that it takes a special level of knowledge to see what we're doing to our world. The second stage of these events is that the public and policymakers start to get concerned solely on the basis of what scientists are saying. And then a third and key step is that the private sector starts to join that concern. And of course, the fundamental purpose of companies is to produce shareholder value, either if it's publicly traded or for the private holders if it's not publicly traded. And so if they see this as a business issue, that they are either they're going to be harmed if nothing is done, or in some cases they realize that something is going to be done and they're going to be seen as bad guys if they aren't if they aren't promoting some sensible solution. So it's sort of interesting to see how the private sector often is initially opposed to any kind of regulation, discounting the science. But then there comes a point where some companies get on board. And then the final step is that some solution is crafted and enacted as policy. All right, I'm going to give you small doses of science here so you can understand the issues. Acid rain, or more generally what's called acid deposition, because there are different ways that human-caused acidity can enter the surface waters, happens in several pathways. The first step is that there are compounds emitted into the atmosphere, largely as shown here, through the burning of coal, smokestack emissions, but also through the smelting of different kinds of ores that contain sulfur. And this symbol NOx, N-O-X, stands for nitrogen oxide, N-O, and also nitric oxide, N-O-2. It's just those two molecules are both represented as NOx. So there are emissions of these gases, SO2 and NOx. In small quantities, they settle directly out of the atmosphere and stick to plants and so on. But more generally, they are oxidized in the atmosphere. That means they're chemically transformed through the agency of oxygen into acids. This is sulfuric acid and this is nitric acid. So these two kinds of acids are actually generated in the atmosphere because of these gases that humans have added. Now, there was acid rain long before we started burning coal. So acid rain is natural, but largely through the agency of ammonia. So the production of ammonia from various natural sources resulted in acid rain, but in much lower concentrations than what humans have produced. And I'll show you some of the comparisons. Then these acids are absorbed into water vapor, into rain droplets, or into snow, and then they fall out as rain or snow onto the ground, and that's what we think of as acid rain, or more generally acid deposition. Any questions about this? Okay. Let's go on to the acid scale, the acidity scale. You may remember your high school chemistry that a pH of 7 is neutral, meaning it's neither acidic nor basic. Higher pHs are increasingly basic until you get to very strongly basic things like ammonia and lye. And as you go to lower values of pH, you're going to higher acidity. You get down here to very corrosive acids like battery acid that you certainly don't want to spill on your hands. And then to things that we actually drink like lemon juice and wine. And you see normal rain is slightly acidic. It's down here typically between a pH of 5 and 6. So rain is normally acidic. What is of concern is when we start to get below values of 5. And in fact, some ponds in upstate New York have been measured at a pH of just above 4. So this is very acidic. So what are some of the effects of acid precipitation? Well, it affects the natural world in several ways. One of the primary ways is as this acid precipitation is running over the soil and over the bedrock, it leaches aluminum out of the ground and into the streams. And so it's putting a compound into the streams that is normally locked up. And both the aluminum and the acidity are toxic to fish. So you start to, in very acidic streams, you start to see fish dying from the acidity. For low pHs, for acidic streams, fish eggs will simply not hatch. So there are toxic effects to living fish, and there's also a delay of reproduction in fish eggs. Now, if the eggs can last until the conditions are right, they will still hatch later. So it's not necessarily lethal. Part of how acid rain was first noticed as a problem was in connection with what was happening to trees. And what it does to trees is it damages the leaves. This is a very visible way of seeing that acid rain is causing damage, is that you see these forests where the trees look as if they're suffering. It doesn't typically kill trees unless it's sustained for a long period of time.
I think it also leaches some of the nutrients out of the soil.
Yeah, and that's the converse of this is that the soils, because of the nitric acid, can actually become saturated in nitrogen, which is also bad for plants. So it disrupts the soil chemistry as well. It does not directly harm humans. If you were to drink water from an acid lake, even a pH of 4, you know, it might taste slightly sour, but it's, you know, nothing like wine or vinegar, and it doesn't actually harm us. However, the original gases, SO2 and NOx, are themselves harmful. So the problems of acid, the problems that cause acid rain, also themselves cause problems to the respiratory system, asthma and bronchitis in particular. Acid rain has very little effect on crops because farmers are continually monitoring the acidity and other chemical properties of their crops and applying fertilizers that are especially balanced to offset any deficiency in the soil. So a sophisticated farmer is going to be way ahead of acid rain, right on top of it, and the crops will not be affected.
But what about organic farmers?
Well, that's a good point. Organic farmers who still use fertilizers, although they're much more restricted in the kinds of fertilizers that they would use. But for instance, if you know if there's a nitrogen excess, there are certain things you can do to correct for that, or if the other nutrients are missing, you can add those nutrients just from organic manure or something like that. So there are options. It also damages buildings, particularly if by corroding metals that have which have free electrons. Bronze is particularly damaged, and also certain kind of basic, more basic stones like marble and limestone.
Can that happen anywhere in the country, or does that happen here?
Well, we'll see where the acid rain is particularly a problem. It's mainly downwind of areas with a lot of coal-fired power plants. So it's mainly the eastern quarter or third of the country where there's a lot of coal plants. And also in Europe. And in fact, a lot of the early science on acid rain was done in Europe. And they could actually, by looking at some of the chemical details and the isotopes in rivers, they could identify which country produced the acid rain that was causing the problem. Because they knew, the compositions of coal in, say, Britain or Germany or Poland. And so the Swedish scientists could say, 80% of our acid rain is coming from Germany. There's some speculation that acid rain damages auto paint. People have noticed these little sort of circular discolorations on cars after a rain, and there's some controversy about whether that's actually caused by acidity or by some other chemical in the rain. So there's some question about that. But it's a range of effects, but none of these really jumps out at you and says, this is apocalypse waiting to happen. And so it's, in some way, that's a little bit surprising that people were concerned enough about it to take steps.
Bridges, it also damages bridges, which we'd like to have sound.
Well, that's true, but most of this damage, it's largely cosmetic. You have to have some very acidic, very prolonged precipitation to get to the point where you're seeing the corrosion go to the kind of the structural level. Although it's with some of the monuments and so on in eastern U.S. and in Europe, there was enough damage that they were starting to have to spend real money to restore them. Well, the effects depend on, and this is partly what some of the questions have been driving at. They depend on exposure. Repeated high levels of acidity, low pH, or in some cases episodic. One example is that the chemistry of snow is such that the accumulation of snow over the course of the winter actually accelerates or enhances the acidity. So when that snow melts, you get what's called an acid shock. You get a huge dose of very acidic water. The second major factor that determines how these effects are felt is the sediment or bedrock type. Obviously, if you have an acid falling on basic soil, the acid and base will react and sort of cancel each other, reduce the acidity. So calcium and magnesium rich soils or bedrock tend to buffer acid precipitation, just meaning they react with and reduce the acidity. But more granitic rocks, which are already kind of acidic, don't provide that buffering. So the northeastern U.S. and southeastern Canada have both this snowmelt component, where a lot of the precipitation is falling in the winter, and then it melts and provides this acid shock. They also have a high level of steady exposure because there's there are a lot of plants around there, sulfur-burning plants or sulfur-producing power plants. And they also tend to have more granitic soils. New Hampshire is the granite state. So they have this sort of triple whammy of everything going against them. High levels of acidity going into the atmosphere, the acid shock, and then not much buffering. Chipmunk right in. Want to go outside? I'm going to run around the room.
Around here.
Probably find its way back. Okay, a little history of acid rain. We tend to think of it as something that arose in the 1950s, but in fact, it was already a concern in the 17th century. Maybe I'll leave this open to you in case you want to take this through. Is this going to set off an alarm?
No, I won't. It's okay. Others may come in.
I was I used to be a high school teacher, and I had our campus was kind of out in the country, and I turned around because I heard this sort of, and I looked, and one of my students in the front row had taken her shoes off, and she had just noticed that while her shoes were off, a garter snake had crawled into one of her shoes. And she kind of backed away from it and fled the room. And so I picked up this poor snake and walked out the door to set it free, and I reached the door just as she was coming back in. It was right at eye level. That just absolutely set her off. I hope this critter isn't going to be disruptive to anyone. Already in the 17th century, there was some concern about acid precipitation, and they had no idea of what would cause it. And this was before coal burning really became widespread. But this is just sort of concern about natural levels of acidity, which retains some variation. But the term acid rain was actually coined in a book written in 1882 by Angus Smith. And this was kind of a revelation at the time. Of course, it was also a revelation to me to discover that this is something that we've known about for 120 years. Concern about air pollution and also about the dying forests in the eastern U.S. and in Europe led to a series of very small policy efforts from 1955 to 1970 to kind of try to dial back some of the sulfur and NOx emissions. But this culminated with the Clean Air Act in 1970, and one of the goals of the Clean Air Act was to eliminate acid precipitation. And the EPA was given, which was also created in 1970, was given authority to set targets of emissions for each state. And then the state had to decide how to reach those targets and submit a formal plan to the EPA, which would then be approved. And once approved, that was the law for that state. And this, this was a modestly ambitious goal to do something that had never been done before. But 20 years later, it was pretty clear that this approach was not working, that the Clean Air Act had been ineffective at tackling acid rain. And so in one of a series of amendments to, or stages of amendments to the Clean Air Act, the acid rain problem was addressed by a very innovative system of cap-and-trade allowances, where 111 power plants, which were actually listed, these were the worst polluters, and they were told, you have to meet a standard of 2.5 pounds of SO2 emission per million BTUs of energy produced by 1995. So it was a target that was set for each plant. Now, that allowance could either be met directly or by buying tradable permits. So in other words, if power plant A could get down to 2 pounds SO2 per million BTUs, then it had a margin of half a pound per million BTUs that it could sell to plant B, which was producing more than its fair share. Now this, this sounds like a little bit dodgy. If you have two kids and you say clean your rooms, and kid A says to kid B, I'll pay you $5 to clean my room, that may achieve the goal that you're after, but maybe one of the goals you're after is getting each kid to take responsibility for cleaning his room. And as we'll see, one of the side effects of this was that certain regions of the country found it systematically, the power plants in those regions, namely the southern Appalachians especially, found it better, more economical to buy their way out of meeting their emissions goals, with the result that the pollution was more concentrated in some regions than in others. So it met the overall goal of reducing emissions, but it did so in a way that you know, left some of the problem intact. So it was an imperfect policy. Now, when we get to carbon dioxide emissions, that's where cap and trade makes a lot of sense, because if you have a power plant in Quebec emitting carbon dioxide, and you have another power plant in Patagonia, in southern South America, they're putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and it's all getting mixed around, and it doesn't matter where it's coming from. So if you reduce it in one place, it's just as good as reducing it somewhere else. With these pollutants, you know, the regional effects are very strong, and there's no carryover, you know, beyond about 1,000 miles. So that was phase one. They targeted these 111 bad guys. Phase two was to go broader to all utilities and require them to reduce emissions of SO2 by an additional 50%. So some of how these reductions were achieved was by installing scrubbers, which are expensive. Others, it was by switching to a lower sulfur coal, which may have been less expensive in some places. Now, the industry reaction to these proposed changes was rather striking. The coal industry sponsored economic studies that predicted that the Clean Air Amendments would cause job losses on the order of 250,000. Now, when you consider that this is comparable to all of the jobs lost during the first three-point-whatever years of the Bush administration during this recession that we've been a long time coming out of, this, you know, this is huge. This, we're talking about one, you know, the effects of reducing sulfur, which really only affects the coal industry, and but they're saying the ripple effects are so huge that you can put 250,000 people out of work. So what actually happened? About 7,000 jobs were lost, and there were an additional roughly 5,000 to 10,000 jobs created through these technological innovations like scrubbers and so on, and you know, environmental engineers and so on. So the net effect to the U.S. economy was probably positive. Nothing like this dire prediction that the, you know, the industry-funded economic studies suggested. And this is a cautionary tale, because you see the same kinds of predictions when we talk about tackling global climate change tomorrow. There are industry studies out there saying it's going to cost us 4% of GDP to tackle this problem. And this wonderful book by Evan Goodstein down at Lewis and Clark College in Portland argues that probably the same kind of error is at work in those studies as well. So this is the map that I promised you about acid rain. This is measurements from 1994. The pH scale is over here on the right, so you see the greens are 5 and above, which is considered pretty healthy. And then you get down to these deep reds, and this is the real problem area back in the early years of the Clean Air Act amendments. You know, you get some point location, the 4.1, 4.2, from these particular measurement points, and there's also they're also monitoring in Alaska. But you can see that, you know, most of the western two-thirds of the country is not really having a problem. There's some coal-fired plants in Wyoming and the Front Range of Colorado that are causing, you know, minor local problems. Let's look at 2002, the most recent year of measurements, and you can see considerable improvement in most of the country, where, you know, we're getting up, you know, the entire region west of Mississippi is now up in the healthy range. The Northeast, still a little bit of a problem, in Quebec, but you know, really a big improvement. But we've really kind of regionalized the problem now to the Northeast and the Southern Appalachians. So a summary of acid rain. Policy-wise, they targeted one single type of source, which is sulfur-burning power plants. There were other sources. There were these smelting operations and other things. But with a single set of regulations and the cap-and-trade system, sulfur dioxide emissions have been reduced by about a third. And that's pretty good. 13 years after the passage of the law, that's a reasonable success story. However, the reduction has not been universal, and particularly the Southern Appalachians have not improved. This is a drawback of cap and trade, that you're allowing one plant to choose how it meets its target, and it may actually continue emitting. And it's clear that further reductions are needed, that there are still damaging effects of acid rain. And in fact, we're going to need to reduce by something like 80% to really clean these up. Great Smoky Mountains National Park is particularly concerned about this because high elevation forests actually get an additional exposure to acid deposition because much of the time they're up in the clouds. And so the clouds themselves are acidic and the particles are sticking, even if it's not actually raining or snowing, there's exposure. So they're very concerned.
To get much improvement though, they're going to have to start targeting NOx, and that means cars.
That's
there's no political will to address that.
That's an excellent point. And that kind of ties into the climate question as well. Other questions or comments about acid rain before we move on to ozone depletion? Okay, so ozone depletion. The concern about ozone arose somewhat after the concern about acid rain. We know that stratospheric ozone protects all living things, except those in the ocean, which are protected by the ocean water, from extreme ultraviolet radiation, UVA. This is, if you remember any physics, this is wavelength shorter than 290 nanometers. The kind of ultraviolet radiation that gives you a sunburn if you're out for half an hour or more, that's UVB. It doesn't kill you unless you get skin cancer from very long exposure. So ozone plays a key role in allowing life to exist. In fact, it was the deductions about the role of the atmosphere in depleting solar UV radiation that led to figuring out that ozone was mostly up in the stratosphere. I'll come back to that in a minute. Now, as we'll see, there's a natural balance of production and destruction of ozone, which was upset by chlorofluorocarbons. And I'll go through the chemistry that leads to that. It's very complicated, but I boiled it down to just the basics. The initial concern about ozone depletion arose in the 70s, but it wasn't until the discovery of the ozone hole that this really kind of kicked things into gear. And a series of international agreements starting in 1985 have nearly phased out the production of chlorofluorocarbons. So this is our greatest success story of a global environmental problem. So let's go through a little bit of the science. This just shows how ozone is produced. Sunlight, namely those very high energy photons of UVA radiation, break apart oxygen, and the free oxygen atom then typically reacts with an oxygen molecule to form ozone. Ozone reacts with the free oxygen atom to go back to O2, and there's this sort of slow conversion from O2 to oxygen, and then a very fast conversion between these two states of more reactive oxygen. So sunlight is breaking apart both ozone molecules and oxygen molecules, and there's sort of like a bathtub where you've left the drain open. There's kind of a continual filling of the ozone reservoir by production of ozone and a continual draining of the ozone reservoir by destruction of ozone, and both are accomplished by sunlight. But it was realized after this was proposed and people worked on it for a while that there had to be more involved, that if this was all that was happening, you'd end up with much too much ozone to explain observations. And so it was realized that there must be some catalytic reactions. Now, a catalyst, if you remember, is an agent of a chemical reaction that causes a chemical reaction and then emerges unchanged on the other side and can therefore do the same reaction over and over and over. And there were a number of candidates for this catalyst, which we'll call X. But this is how the catalytic reaction works. X reacts with ozone to break it apart and glom onto one of the free oxygen atoms, leaving a more stable oxygen molecule. then this oxide of X also can react with ozone to again strip off an oxygen atom, which then leads to having two oxygen molecules, and X is then free to go back and do the same thing over and over again. The net result is that you've taken two ozone molecules and turned them into three oxygen molecules. And if there's nothing to take X out of action, then this can go on indefinitely. In fact, in some cases, a typical molecule of X can do this 100,000 times before it then reacts with something else to take it out of production. So here are some early candidates for X. HOX, H-O-X, which again, sort of like the NOX, which we've already seen, was produced, it's just H-O or H-O-2. And concerns about emissions of water vapor, which might produce HOX, helped nix the supersonic transport around 1971, when the U.S. was considering building a fleet of supersonic transports just like the European Concorde. Boeing got very concerned, actually, about ozone depletion through this HOX cycle. NOx, likewise, a little later, arose as a candidate to explain these catalytic reactions. It's produced by N2O, nitrous oxide. And this also was a concern that SSTs would produce nitrogen compounds. Combustion produces nitrogen compounds. And so this was also a concern about SSTs. It wasn't until the early 70s that attention focused on chlorine as a possible catalytic agent. And there was also some concern about space shuttle launches, that these the combustion of the gases that drove the space shuttle would produce chlorine. And this was something NASA was well underway with, and they really did not want to see the space shuttle program shut down over concerns of ozone depletion. So they put a lot of effort into trying to understand the chlorine cycle. So, a little history. Ozone was discovered in 1839. A guy was just sort of noticing the funny smell that happened around lightning or electric sparks, which produced ozone. And if you've ever stood near a photocopier, you can smell ozone, and I wouldn't advise breathing it because it damages your lungs. By 1900, scientists deduced that a large amount of ozone must be floating up in the stratosphere, because they could measure ozone, and there were, wherever they looked, there were very low amounts of ozone in the troposphere, down where the weather is. So they figured it must be hiding out up there somewhere, and the stratosphere seemed a candidate. And they knew that there must be large amounts of it because of the amount of ultraviolet radiation that was absorbed. Chlorofluorocarbons were discovered actually in the 19th century. This also was a shock to me. And they were produced beginning in 1880. They have these marvelous properties. They're non-reactive, which means that if you put them in a container, it's not going to corrode the container. If you spray them onto something, it's not going to corrode that. If somebody breathes it, it won't hurt them because it won't react with the lungs or anything else. So they were used in a wide range of applications. You know about probably aerosol spray cans. They were also used in refrigeration and air conditioners. They were also used for blown foam, polyurethane foam, which was used for both hard insulation and soft things like furniture cushions and so on. So they were just marvelous chemicals. They did all these wonderful things, and they appeared to have no harmful side effects. However, there was this growing concern about the causes and effects of ozone loss. Even though no one had observed any ozone loss, and I'll come back to that in a minute, there were attempts to analyze existing ozone data, and there was also not a really good understanding of what the effects of ozone loss would be. Okay, we've got this ozone layer, it's important, but how much could we really deplete it before we started getting an uptick in skin cancer as a result, for example? 1972, a DuPont scientist wondered, in a conversation with a couple of other scientists, where chlorofluorocarbons went. You know, they'd been producing these things for 90 years, and they knew that they went into the atmosphere, and they, you know, said, well, they don't react with anything as far as we know, but, you know, what happens to them? Are they accumulating in the atmosphere? And so they started doing some measurements and some analysis, and they figured out, well, they aren't, you know, they aren't producing any harm to humans. But it was Sherwood Rowland and Mario Molina in 1974 who deduced that what happened to the chlorofluorocarbons was, in fact, they didn't react with anything. They floated up into the stratosphere where, guess what? Ultraviolet radiation broke them down, so that meant that they had to get up above the ozone layer to get broken down into a reactive form of chlorine. And bingo, now you've got a way to get chlorine into the stratosphere where it can destroy ozone and accelerate one of those catalytic cycles. This just sent shockwaves throughout the political world because, you know, well, gee, we've been kind of worried about what would happen if something were damaging the ozone layer. Now we've got something that is damaging the ozone layer, and we know it is. These guys, incidentally, won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in the late 90s, and it's the only time atmospheric scientists have ever won a Nobel Prize. It may happen again someday. Well, the response was fairly swift. Late in the Nixon administration, this IMOS panel, a federal panel of federal scientists, was formed. IMOS stands for Inadvertent Modification of the Stratosphere. Talk about oops. Ooh, gee, what are we doing? They were formed, and in 1975, they recommended banning chlorofluorocarbons. This was a radical step. They just went straight from, you know, last year this paper postulated that chlorine could get into the atmosphere through CFCs, into the stratosphere, and destroy ozone, even though we hadn't observed any reduction in ozone. This was just a really radical step. In response, the state of Oregon and the state of New York banned the sale of CFC aerosols. Now, aerosols were responsible for 50% of what we call the ozone risk. They were a minority of the production, but because they were immediately released into the atmosphere on use, unlike some of these other applications like refrigerators, where the whole idea was to keep them in a pipe for 30 years. So these were a disproportionate risk. They were also easily replaced. There are a lot of other things, other gases you can put in a can to make it expand and push something out. They're also highly emissive. So this was kind of an easy first step, and it was interesting that it was state actions that happened first. And of course, some of you may remember in the 70s when this whole, you know, fear about what aerosol spray cans were doing to the ozone layer swept through the public, and as a result, even, you know, in states where they were actually banned, consumers just said, I'm not going to buy those. You know, there were alternatives, said, you know, ozone safe and whatever. And so they plummeted 75% just within 3 years. At the same time, the small group of companies that were producing CFCs funded a fairly inept public relations campaign where they went around espousing some really crappy science. For example, they were saying that, well, volcanoes produce more chlorine than we do in CFCs. Now, the difference is that volcanoes produce hydrochloric acid, HCl, which is highly water-soluble. And so if you have a volcanic eruption that puts a bunch of gunk in the atmosphere, water vapor is going to stick to it, if it can, and then it rains out, and whatever chlorine you've produced is just landing on the ground. And so this was just, you know, a feeble attempt, and they lost pretty quickly. However, some companies also recognized the writing on the wall and that there was a market to be gained. You know, they're looking at these plummeting sales and saying, okay, well, if we want to stay in this game, we have to produce substitutes. And remember, it's CFC producers, very small number of companies, but then there are a lot of companies, you know, refrigerator companies, polyurethane foam companies, aerosol spray can companies that are the consumers of CFCs. So they're looking to their suppliers and saying, hey, if you can't give me a CFC-free version of this, I'm going somewhere else. So this was, you know, market forces. And kind of late in the game, the U.S. government said, okay, we're going to ban aerosols. You know, by the time the market had already kind of said, we're going to ban aerosols just by not buying them. But still, it was, you know, it was a good step. Well, what about the rest of the world? Really following the lead of the U.S., and this, you know, for those of you who are kind of paying attention to modern environmental problems, it may come as a surprise that Europe was kind of following in our wake, but a few European nations also enacted aerosol bans, but none of them was actually using as much aerosols as the U.S. So these were kind of small steps, and actually a lot of European nations didn't even want to damage their CFC-producing industry, so they didn't even do this. A lot of discussion about regulating the other applications for CFCs, the non-aerosol purposes, really slowed down as the industry got more organized. The producers and the consumers of CFCs, all those companies banded together to form the Alliance for Responsible CFC Policy. You know, really good sounding name, but actually, as we'll see, they turned out to be able to move when it was time to move. And of course, when Reagan was elected in 1980, that really kind of shut down any progress on banning CFCs. And also at the same time, as I alluded to earlier, analysis of what ozone observations there were suggested that, you know, there were a lot of fluctuations, but that we hadn't actually seen any decline. And so people looked at that and said, well, you know, what's the problem? We've got the CFCs, you say they're going to destroy the ozone layer, but we don't see anything happening to the ozone layer. But a more nuanced understanding of the science, first of all, we're using instruments built in the 1920s, which had huge calibration problems. They had a lot of degradation. It was very difficult to maintain long-term stability. Furthermore, models said, well, okay, the amount of chlorine we've already got in the atmosphere would only deplete the ozone layer by 1 or 2%, which is really not detectable. So what we're talking about is something models say will happen in the future. Now keep that in mind, because that comes back when we talk about global climate change. How much have we seen? How much do we expect to see? How much we'll see in the future? So up to 1985, there was really very little progress. Once the U.S. banned aerosols in 1978, that was a huge step. But then not much happened. So the bombshell, which was the discovery of the ozone hole. Now, ozone hole, you know, sort of conjures up all sorts of incorrect notions of what it is. So let me explain what it is. This is Antarctica, and what we're seeing is a satellite view of the amount of ozone in the entire atmosphere, what we call the ozone column. And these colors indicate that quantity in what are called Dobson units. And you can see in mid-latitudes of the southern hemisphere, there's typically around 350 to 400 Dobson units. And for most of the year, that's true also over Antarctica. But starting in August, when conditions are right, what turns out to be a very fast catalytic reaction involving chlorine essentially destroys all the ozone in a layer about 8 kilometers thick. And so in this layer, and actually the conditions are that very, very cold ice clouds in the stratosphere can form. When those ice clouds form, they provide a surface for chemical reactions that can't happen in gases. So it's called heterogeneous chemistry. Chlorine, even though it's broken up by ultraviolet radiation, fairly quickly goes into two stable gases, hydrochloric acid or chlorine nitrate, ClO, NO2. Those two reservoirs of chlorine are pretty safe. But when they encounter both these ice particles in these clouds and sunlight, boom, the chlorine's liberated and it goes to town and it destroys every ozone molecule in sight. So this is the satellite view. This is the ozone hole in October 1987. Once the clouds go away, the ozone destruction stops. And the clouds typically evaporate by October, and then this this massive air over Antarctica gets broken up and the ozone hole disappears. These are observations from the British Antarctic Survey of the total ozone averaged over the month of October from Halley Bay, and I don't remember where their site is, but you can see that up until the 1970s, there wasn't a whole lot of change, and then about 1975, the ozone amount started to really plummet as this ozone hole developed, as the amount of chlorine in the stratosphere increased. And they released this paper in 1985, and it was really a shock because these satellite observations dated back to 1979, and they had missed it entirely. How could they miss something as glaring as this? Well, the computer programmers who developed the algorithm for treating the satellite data said, we have to have some kind of flag for if the values are just nonsense. So if our retrieval comes up with an answer that's either bigger than 650 or smaller than 180, we're going to throw it out. So they were just throwing out the evidence of the ozone hole. And you can imagine major egg on the face when 6 years after they started making observations, these antiquated British scientists with their silly balloons come out with this paper saying there's this ozone hole. But anyway, they went back and reprocessed the data, and there it was. And so we can now see this nice sequence of the ozone hole for each October from 1980 to 1991. And you can see that in some years, particularly 1987, which we just saw, it was quite bad. 1987 was the worst to date. It actually got worse in the 90s and has since kind of leveled off, thanks to the policy changes that we're about to see. Now, the ozone hole has also produced all sorts of rather hilarious things. This was just the Weekly World News just a few weeks ago. This was the issue that said on the front cover, I don't know if you saw it in the tabloids, Dick Cheney is a robot. It showed him peeling back his skin to show the whole mechanic. So farther in here, hole in the ozone, sucking penguins into outer space. Scientists are alarmed by the recent discovery that the ozone hole is sucking penguins into outer space in Antarctica. They get too close and whoosh, up they go. I even lost my favorite camp stove. So obviously this is nonsense, but okay, so could you go to the animation of the ozone hole? So this is actually just from last fall, and you'll see that the ozone hole is much smaller now. This is August, going into September, it's starting to form, and now early October, and this is about its maximum extent. You see it kind of has wobbles getting into November, and usually by this time of year it's completely gone. We had a particularly cold winter down there last winter, and it lasted into the spring, but this is not as severe in ozone hole as we used to see 5 or 10 years ago. So it's already starting to recover. So let's go back to the PowerPoint. So how did this happen? How did we get... Yes, question.
Since the hole is over Antarctica, it doesn't affect just Antarctica, it affects...
Well, there was some concern because... I think around the same time the ozone hole was discovered, there was an epidemic of sheep blindness in New Zealand. And there were some fears that was because of the increased ultraviolet radiation. In fact, it turned out to be a bacterial infection or something. That was
an epidemic of what?
Sheep blindness. Oh. Sheep were going blind. And of course, there are more sheep than people in New Zealand, so they were really worried about that. Basically, the amount of ozone in the atmosphere is lowest in the tropics, except during the time of the ozone hole. And in fact, one of the arguments that was made against doing anything about ozone depletion was that these few percent that we're talking about is equivalent to moving from Seattle to Portland. Which the farther south you go, the less ozone there is, the more direct the sunlight is. So those two combinations. Those two factors in combination. And if you were to move from here to Indonesia, that's far more risk than we're talking about with ozone depletion. So October in Antarctica, nobody's out sunbathing. You know, so that the direct effect was not what was concerning people. It was the mere fact that we were changing and weakening the ozone layer. You know, certainly there were some activists at the beginning who wanted to be able to say, we got to solve this or everybody's going to die of skin cancer. You know, the evidence just wasn't there for that. It was merely the concern about, you know, we're damaging our protective ozone layer.
There was also a smaller hole over the North Pole, and that's much closer to habitat.
Yes and no. In fact, what happened in the North Pole is somewhat different. And this is part of the irony that, you know, all the release of CFCs is in the Northern Hemisphere, but the biggest effects are over Antarctica. You know, this just kind of reminded us that, you know, some of these gases travel throughout the whole atmosphere, and they may collect and do things in one place. The Northern hemisphere is a little different, and we always have more ozone at high latitudes than at mid latitudes. So if there's an ozone hole in the Northern Hemisphere, it's just a reduction below the high amounts we would expect. But that did not prevent then-Senator Al Gore from referring to an ozone hole over Kennebunkport as a sort of warning in 1990. So I need to kind of wrap up here. There was really no progress in the early 80s, even though there were attempts at international negotiations. But following the discovery of the ozone hole, there were some major breakthroughs in 1986. This Alliance for Responsible CFC Policy, which I referred to, suddenly came out in favor of a freeze of CFC production. They could see the writing on the wall. The chairman of the alliance said he didn't want to be a shill for an industry that was ignoring science, and so he just came out and said, we're in favor of a freeze. Now, a freeze was not what most people were calling for. They were calling for severe reductions in production, but this was, in fact, a huge step. Second, in what just shocked Europeans at the negotiations, the U.S. showed up for one of these negotiating sessions, and remember, this is the Reagan administration, and they said, we think we should cut CFC production by 95%. And now the Europeans had been arguing about whether it should be 20% or 50%. And they were, you know, and meanwhile the US had been sort of saying, well, you know, we don't know if we want to do anything. And then suddenly the US goes for the whole enchilada. And this blew everybody away. And in fact, there were people in Congress who said, we will do this reduction alone if need be. And a couple of Republican senators introduced a bill in the Senate that passed that the U.S. would go for an 85% reduction unilaterally. So this was just huge. And really more as a result of this than the discovery of the ozone hole, there was a breakthrough agreement in Montreal in 1987, which was a 50% cut in CFC production, 5 CFCs, by 1998. Subsequent amendments to this protocol, and one of the neat things about the protocol is it left a lot of room for changes in the direction of more gases, more nations participating. And they actually accelerated the phase out so that this is the total stratospheric chlorine amounts accumulating in under a business as usual scenario here in the black line. The Montreal Protocol would have done this. Still not a huge help. I mean, 50% reduction is one thing, but the thing is, it's accumulating. So as long as you're emitting it, it's accumulating. The London and Copenhagen amendments, just within the span of 5 years, brought it down to the point where CFC amounts, where chlorine amounts in the stratosphere actually have peaked and are declining. So this was a huge success. And we're starting to see possible recovery of the ozone hole. So why was this so successful? We have now, the human race has reduced CFC emissions by more than 95%. So even more than the U.S.'s outlandishly ambitious proposal in 1986, we have done it. Why? First of all was U.S. leadership, the fact that the U.S. was out in the front saying, let's solve this problem. Broad public support, as represented by a 96-0 Senate vote on this issue in the early 90s. Also, scientific assessments were very clear and compelling, stating that, you know, ozone depletion was finally being observed. laying out the case for the connection between chlorine and ozone depletion and so on and so on. Another major factor on the private sector was that they could develop replacements and get them to market quickly. Big plus. And industry grudgingly came on board, not just by providing these replacements, but they also came on board as part of the assessment process, the technology assessment, saying what was possible. When DuPont, a major CFC producer, said in 1986, well, 5 years ago, we looked into this and we figured out what it would take to develop replacements for most of the CFC applications, and we think we can do it in, you know, a few years. That was a major catalyst. Another major factor, and this is going to play when we start talking about global climate change, is that nobody really noticed that CFCs went away. In fact, as late as the late 90s, 20 years after aerosols were banned, some people were still saying, well, I don't use aerosol spray cans because they destroy the ozone layer. You know, people had it in their minds that this was a problem and that this one simple action would solve it, and, you know, actually, they were 20 years out of date. But it didn't cost us anything, really, to solve this problem. It was a matter of getting a few companies to go along. So I think that's the end. So this is a really encouraging success story, especially the ozone depletion. International agreement to solve global environmental problems is possible. But key was U.S. leadership, public support, stoked by environmental organizations, and also the cooperation of the private sector, you know, culprits, if we want to call that, or that, or causes. So these are some great success stories, and they should provide us some encouragement for tackling the bigger problems, but they're also, as you can see, there are also some major differences that will make it more difficult. And I think we're out of time.
Thank you.